Good morning. As you will have gathered, we're not on our normal slot on the wireless, but that means we can bring you a slightly longer podcasted playback, unfettered by the constraints of commerce and the tyranny of the clock. Ooh, giddy with excitement. So, let's kick off with Liveline. And on Tuesday, there was what one person might politely call a heated debate, and another might refer to as a humdinger of a scrap.
Malachy, how
do you know what most of the... I don't know what most listeners think. How do you know?
Well, Joe, you see, now you're being smart, right?
I'm as you're saying most of your listeners...
Joe, do you want the statue removed?
I will never answer that question.
Yes or no?
I will never answer that question.
Well, the statue in question is that of controversial Republican Sean Russell. And the statue was in Fairview Park in Dublin. And the base of the statue was painted with many lovely bright colours, which some argued might have been the colours of the Pride flag. More and on. But let's start off with Russell's links to Nazism. And going head to head, we have Joe Scrapper Duffy and Malachy. Bring it on, Steenson. Here's just a little of how heated things got.
Do you think the statue should be removed? Let me come
back. I certainly do not. Let me say this. Sean Russell came from this area. His family came from this area. He lived all his life on the North Strand Road, on top of where Paddy Power's bookshop, Bookies, is now. He is a man of this area.
So what?
He has no grave.
So what?
And if we want... Hold on. If the people of this area and Republicans want a statue, which is not a state statue. This is a statue put up by the National Graves Association in 1951. And I'm proud to say my mother... and her brothers were part of the Republican movement.
Yeah, why was the statue erected to him?
Because people wanted it erected. People in the area wanted it erected.
He said it was the
a local man who was a veteran of the 1916 Rising, who fought and was director of munitions in the War of Independence, who was quartermaster in the counter-revolution and who led the IRA in the 1930s and 40s, or until he died in 1940.
Against the legitimately elected sovereign government of Ireland.
He fought in
didn't
the...
It? Now, will you answer the question, Malachy? Am I right?
By the way, every
event you mentioned there's only one common thread, violence.
Oh, so... We shouldn't have had the revolution in 1916.
No, that's not the argument.
He was a soldier.
He was killing people and advocating bombing Britain in the 1930s.
Who did he kill? Hold on.
He was advocating killing people. I don't know who he killed. What was he advocating? Hugs?
Let me answer the question.
What was he doing in Nazi Germany?
Let me answer the question.
Yeah, well, answer the question. What was he doing in Nazi Germany? Being driven around by the Nazis and being fed and watered by them.
Are you telling me the answer or are you asking me the question?
He was collaborating with the Nazis.
Are you asking me the question?
Or are you giving
me the answer?
Well, you give the answer.
Which is it? Well, if you let me, without interrupting me, I'll be able to give you the answer. He went to Germany just as the IRB did and just as everybody else did in every decade past. The same as they went to the Soviet Union, as Russell did, the same as they went to America to obtain weapons. Where did Roger Casement get the weapons that he was bringing in? Why did Patrick Pearce say at his court martial that Germany is no more to him than England, that he asked for German aid in the shape of arms and an expeditionary force, and he neither asked for it nor accepted German gold, that his only traffic with Germany was that, and that his aim was to win Irish freedom?
What's
the difference?
Will you let me answer the question? The difference is that when Sean Russell went to Nazi Germany to try and get arms from the Nazis, he was not representing the Irish government.
Not representing the Irish government, well. But Malachy and Joe were never, ever going to see eye to eye on this one. Because Malachy seemed to draw a line between comments Taoiseach Leo Varadkar had made on 2FM, which called for a debate around certain statues we have in public places. And he linked that with the vandalism of the Sean Russell statue.
But but you're not going to allow a debate. And it's clear from your comments.
It's now 23, Monarchy. You've been on.
That you're not prepared to listen. No, and you can't even follow the logic of the Taoiseach saying something and somebody acting on that.
All I tried to do, and maybe listeners are fed up with this now, but all I was trying to do, yourself.
Oh, yes, I'm sure that.
Can
if you actually allow the debate to take place, Joe,
the debate did take place. Let's measure the amount of time you've had, Malachy, in the last 40 minutes. The point I was making was you, Malachy Steenson, you're a well-known Republican or stood for the Workers' Party or whatever. Des Dalton is a well-known Republican Sinn Féin, former president. Both of you came on, both of you got on, both of you contacted us, both of you got on, both of you were putting the one side on the Sean Russell argument. It's my job as a presenter here, I do it on every argument. If there is another side, which there is, to try and put it forward until someone comes on to make that point, if they're willing to make that point. But anyway, that's all I was doing.
Well, either we support the vandalism of statues or we don't, Joe.
Oh, and there she blows. That was Malachy Steenson with Joe on Tuesday. And statues were making the news on Wednesday. In this instance, two different statues of Luke Kelly were daubed with paint. One on South King Street by sculptor John Call, and the other on Sheriff Street by sculptor Vera Clute. And it was the sixth time that particular statue had been vandalised. On Drive Time, Fergal Keane went down to Sheriff Street to get local reaction.
It's a disgrace. It's just sheer vandalism. Just vandalism. Why would that man, a man that gave great love to this country and countries beyond, why would anybody want to deface him? Nothing else to do. Mindless people. Thugs.
Look yourself. It's not kids that's doing it either. But I think you won't put on the radio, so in Egypt, that's what I think.
Is it not bad enough that we have to hide from COVID? That they have to go around now defacing statues belonging to great people. People that done the area proud and just, you know, I just can't accept it. It's lovely to come down here and see the amount of tourists that stand there and take photographs. It's brilliant to see it. It's a great tourist attraction. You'd be amazed. And even Irish people, the amount of people locally that come around and have a little yap with them and talk. It's unbelievable. It's great to see it.
Who do you think is doing this?
They're from the area across the road, I think. They're not from this area. Not all the time now. But they have been seen on cameras and heading back over the other direction.
A lot of people are very upset, you know.
Why do you think it's happening?
We haven't a clue. We haven't a clue why people are doing it, you know. It's unfortunate. They could put a railings around it if they could, you know what I mean? And try and stop it altogether. Ah, it's the same when I was a kid, yeah? He'd be walking in there with the flats with his book in his arm and that, you know. He was okay, nice fella. Nice fella, nice polite man, you know. He'd always say hello to you and that, you know. It's a sad thing that things like that is happening.
Locals on Sheriff Street in Dublin about the vandalism of their Luke Kelly statue. Across town, the sculptor of the other statue, John Call, spoke to Sarah McInerney, and he took a more philosophical approach.
I actually thought we were dodging the bullet for the last couple of weeks, because it was happening to Vera's that this is pure copycat stuff. You know, I think there are a lot of young people out there who have a lot of time on their hands and maybe a little bit frustrated and just looking for something to, you know, something to do.
How did you feel about it, waking up this morning and seeing that?
Public sculpture these days, if you're making a public sculpture, you have to take into consideration that anything will happen to it. And unfortunately, graffiti and is part of the urban thing, you know. So I was feeling a bit lucky that it hadn't happened yet, but I was kind of half expecting it, to be honest with you, you know. So my feelings were, okay, it's done, and now one of the great things about bronze is it is bloody indestructible. The paint is just on the surface. We'll use a paint cleaner on it, clean it off. Luke will get another coat of wax, and he'll look as good as he did the day he went in, a year and a half ago.
Okay.
You know. So in terms of it's a little bit of a distraction, but basically it doesn't really affect the piece, you know.
Sculptor John Call. And on the same programme, Sarah spoke to independent councillor Christy Burke, and he'd been contacted with a suggestion as how best to proceed.
I had an email from a guy in Navan saying, let's leave the paint on it. Maybe that's the irritate, the perpetrator.
Do you think it's worth considering?
It's outside the box. What do you think, John?
No, Christy, I would, certainly the one on South King Street, like, they just threw the paint on it. Like, there was no attempt at anything creative there. So, no. Sorry, let's just get rid of it. And listen, most of the paint, actually, I was very disappointed that the paint, it's very low-grade paint that they threw on.
It's white emulsion, John.
Oh, right. Okay. So they've no taste in paint, these vandals. All right, well, listen, thank you both very much.
Oh, nice bit of Farron ball, maybe elephant's breath. Better class of vandalism. Now, for the past few weeks, The Ray D'Arcy Show have been asking listeners to get in touch with short autobiographical moments called A Page from My Life. Here is the winning entry by Elaine Wilbur, read by the author herself.
We climb to the top of the high wall around Kelly's Field. Come on, she says, just stand up. It'll be faster. Kelly's Field has the biggest hay jump. We heard that you could jump from the railway bridge. She wants to go and I want to be her. I watch her knotty legs stretch in front of each other, her socks inside her corked German sandals. That smile she flicks backwards is warm and taunting, the same smile she has when she loans me another 10p for a chickadees or a rubble bubble. I want to get up out of my 9 years of milky ordinariness, to shrug off early bedtimes and my Enid Blyton collection, to be White's life tan for a day, normal for everyone else except me. Be brave, I say to myself, but my body refuses. My raspberry ripple knees grip both sides of the concrete block so tightly I feel printed with gravelly ridges. Those indents are the branding of my weakness. I knew I would never stand next to her or walk along this imagined tightrope. Sorry. I knew it in the same way I knew I hated wet potatoes in my mother's stew. I'd probably have to go back for dinner, I say, and drop my leg down into my shame, searching for solid ground. I see her knowing smirk as she skims away from me. Her form briefly covers the sun, and I lower myself into her shadow before coming back to earth. I wipe the ingrained rubble from my knees and I make my way home. I hear the faraway screams of the hay jump threaded through the cuckoo's call. The tarmac falls under my footsteps and I look back at my temporary mark. As I round the corner, I see my brothers playing curb to curb. I hear the plastic spoke beads of someone's bike rattling closer, someone who gets Kellogg's Frosties more than once a year and doesn't have to fight for the plastic treasure inside. My fingers thrum along the different wrought iron gates I pass. Each gap in a wall brings me closer to our opening. I have the scooped out feeling that something is missing. I look behind me wondering if I was worth following for once. But I know that her reach is always further than mine. I will always drop with the anchor while she soars with the sail. She is Mary and I am Laura, the Elizabeth to her Jessica. She is racerback tan lines and I am sunburned freckles. She is Quinsworth, I am Duns. She zooms along with her inline skates while I paint a P in my wooden tennis racket with black shoe polish. It's Wednesday, so that means steaklets and chips. I can smell it coming through the front door as I round the pillars. I like Wednesdays. I still do.
Elaine Wilbur reading her story, which was the overall winner of A Page from My Life, as heard on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Over on Lyric, Culture Files' Luke Clancy was talking to music and technology researcher Sherry Hu about the impact of TikTok on the global music industry. But first, a wee explainer. I bet you hadn't known me.
Why don't you say so? TikTok is a short form video app, I think is the simplest way to put it. Any user can download TikTok and start posting their own short form videos. There's a lot of different like editing and captioning you can do on your videos. One major differentiator with TikTok is that sound and music both play a really important role. A lot of the most popular content on TikTok revolves around music, around whether it's like dance challenges or people just putting a song into really interesting and really funny contexts. I think one really fascinating element of TikTok that I think will have an influence on pop culture in general is the ability of so many people to tell a story in such a short amount of time. Like if you only have 10 to 15 seconds, what's the most interesting narrative you can put together? And you see that in, I guess, the musical snippets or excerpts that gain the most traction.
And the power of the app to make global hits was demonstrated with the mega song Old Town Road, which falls under the dubious moniker of country rap. Born in the bedroom of singer Lil Nas X, it's gone on to break records and forge careers.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse through the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take
the story of Old Town Road is so fascinating and like just like checks off all the boxes of a really interesting like breakout story about someone who like was relatively unknown but who just happened to be really savvy with social media, creating the song, this kind of like tongue-in-cheek song just for fun in a way that combined country and hip-hop in this very, you know, tongue-in-cheek way that people hadn't really heard before, like intentionally using dance challenges as the primary marketing vehicle, even if, you know, only 10 seconds of a song were included in the video. It ended up getting a lot of viral traction, and that was also one of the first examples of people actually being really interested in the song because it wasn't a sound they had heard before, and so then going to Spotify, Apple Music, and other streaming services and actually streaming the song in full. And then, you know, a major label like Columbia Records noticing Lil Nas X and then signing him to a deal that then went on to break, you know, history on the Billboard charts. Given that TikTok is relatively new, I think we haven't really seen any kind of trajectory like that, at least like from independent to major label history making artist in a matter of a year.
So might this TikTok model be the future for the music industry?
Does the way TikTok works begin to shape what people decide to make or release as music?
Oh, absolutely. I've already heard in a lot of conversations, people are using the phrase like TikTok record. How do we make a TikTok record? How do we make a TikTok song? This is my personal opinion. I don't know if that's like the most effective way to think about it. I think this is the latest step in a pattern throughout history of artists molding their songs to the most popular technological formats of the time. What I think is especially interesting is that the unit of focus is even shorter because the TikTok video is not 3 minutes long. So if you're trying to maximize virality in some way on TikTok or your chances of going viral, you really only have to think about the specific earworm that you want to be promoting, like the specific 5 second, 10 second lyrical and musical hook. A lot of people have differing opinions on whether that kind of enhances or reduces creativity, but that is very much a reality in terms of how artists are thinking.
Sherry Hu with Luke Clancy on Culture File. Actor Maxine Peake was Sean Rock's guest on Arena, and she was primarily talking about her new film, which is called Fanny Lai Delivered. It's set in mid-17th century Cromwellian England and will be released across digital platforms this week. But Peake is also a renowned theatre actor, so Sean Rocks asked her what future she envisages for an environment where getting close to the smell of grease paint is key.
What about theatre where, you know, that live experience sitting in an open space, looking at somebody up on the stage in front of you? We hear lots of concern about, will big companies, important companies, will they survive this period? What are your feelings around the possibilities and the problems for theatre at this time?
Well, it's frightening. It's scary, scary times, you know, and you've got people like Cameron McIntosh saying, I'm going to close my theatres and they won't be open until next year, you know, and it's not just the people on the stage. It's the people behind the scenes. It's the people in the offices. It's the people in the front of the house. It's, you know, it's a huge industry. It's devastating. And how do you come back from that? And I wish I had some answers. And, you know, and I know there's lots of qualified people out there are really, you know, people are really working to find, you know, solutions to this. But it's scary times, I think, for theatres, and, you know, theatres are going into receivership, and, you know, smaller companies especially, that, you know, some companies won't come back from this, which is really, really sad, you know. It breaks my heart because you think some of these West End companies, they've made millions and millions. I mean, who am I to say, but maybe they could look after the staff better. But anyway, you know, I don't know the ins and outs, and I'm not an accountant, but you know, it seems people need support. Mm. And I think, I don't know what the future is for theatre. I'm hopeful, of course, it will bounce back, but there'll be some people, that some companies, some theatres, you know, that just won't be able to come back from this, and that's heartbreaking.
Maxine Peake on Arena. And comedians are also in something of a bind, because stand up to a laughter track, well, it's really not going to cut it. Neil Delamere was on with Ray Darcy to talk about RTE Does Comic Relief, and mean guidance counsellor Darcy didn't shy away from interrogating Neil's career prospects.
Like, if you look,
are you worried?
Am I worried that the careers that I've chosen to do no longer exists, Ray? I mean,
you said that, I didn't say it, but
well, cognizant of the fact that an awful lot of people have had much more serious time than me.
What did you do before stand-up?
I was a software engineer.
Oh, yeah.
But the good thing is that I've been so long out of software engineering, nothing has changed in the time. You know, I've done it 20 years ago. I think all my skills are bang up to date. I'm pretty sure I can knock out the old Amstrad Commodore 64 and get right back into Donkey Kong or whatever with the laughing I was. No, I mean, I have no transferable skills whatsoever. So we better hope that vaccine is discovered fairly shortly, Ray. Otherwise, I'll be just ringing around to you. Do you want any odd jobs done?
And not content with undermining his job security and general sense of well-being, why wasn't Neil Delamere just churning out creative content like a small to medium laugh enterprise? Could it really be that hard?
And yet they're given all this time at home, and I suppose there's pressure on you to be creative and, you know, to write a show or write a sitcom or write a book or...
Yeah, well,
do
I
you feel
that
pressure?
So the first week I just watched a lot of heist films. I love heist films and I love prison break films, and I don't know why. My wife said to me, I think it's because you like the planning involved. I was like, there's a lot of planning in a wedding. I don't think I want to watch Ocean's 11. If Ocean's 11 was about who sits beside who at the top table, I don't think I'd watch it. So the first couple of weeks for me, just kind of relaxing into it and going, okay, this is enforced time. And then after that, I did feel that pressure of, you should be writing your next show, you should be doing this, that and the other. And then about 11 or 12 days in, I read this article about, do you know, people were saying that Isaac Newton wrote all his best work when he was in quarantine for the plague.
Didn't know that.
And a lot of people going, oh, this is what he did. And then I read this article that said, well, no, he was working on this well before that and well after it. And also, note to self, you're not Isaac Newton, one of the great geniuses of your age. That kind of took the pressure off, I'll be honest with you then.
Neil Delamere with Ray. While face masks are becoming de rigueur for any outing, particularly on public transport, how to get the mask to match the rig out can be a challenge for the fashion conscious. New bride Emer Downing has just been married in Bergamo in northern Italy, a town that was the epicentre for COVID-19 only a few short weeks ago. She told Mary Wilson how she said yes to the dress and the mask.
And I looked at a photograph of your wedding party, beautiful dress, by the way, at the registry office. And I suppose the most striking thing when you look, you were all wearing masks. And I gather you customised your bridal mask.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, actually, funny story there. I'm known for liking my arts and crafts and kind of putting things together with what I can find around the place. And I made Luca's mask during lockdown out of an old black top of mine. And then I'd made a white mask with some ribbon I had for myself. But then I was saying the colour didn't look right with the dress. So I decided to make something different. Couldn't find anything in whatever shops were open. So I went to a shop and thought, oh, if I find some clothes, maybe that'll work. I could maybe cut up a shirt or something that's lacy. And I found the perfect thing, which is a pair of lacy knickers. So that's the bottom of a pair of lace knickers on my face.
On your face, when necessity is the mother of invention, as they say, and it looks very well. In fact, I thought it was the same material as your dress. It looks a perfect, an absolutely perfect match. Look, congratulations to both of you.
COVID cool, very impressive. That was the newly married Emer Downing on Drive Time. On Countrywide, Seamus O'Rourke brought us this very beautiful piece called The Drawer.
He was an easygoing man, that's what they said, easygoing. And he was. My father had a drawer under the bench in the shed that was his go-to place, the somewhere he went for peace and clarity or just time. The drawer had divisions made from scalps of wood, divided to hold washers and nuts and split pins and plugs, roll plugs for masonry. It was a farmer's emporium of knick-knacks and tools. Everything was there. Anything you'd use to fix farming equipment or stuff about the house. But it wasn't always what was in the drawer that the old man saw. It was the world around him when it got disturbed. It was his place for reflection and welding and grinding, for sorting out questions and sometimes, not always, finding answers. If we wouldn't do homework or crash the good car, if there was a row over football or someone let him down somehow, he'd go to the shed and he'd open the drawer and he'd start footering and figuring and scratching and banging. And after surmising, he'd put all away and he'd take a deep breath and he'd have the last say. Of course he did, he was the boss. He kept everything there, all the rivets and screws and a packet of lockets that never got used and fuses. He had a compartment for fuses all to themselves, said they were safer there than above on the shelves, and they were. There was the good spanner, it was missing, though he still had the box, and he kept the bulbs in it, and there was a whole section for locks, and he had a load of keys. He had keys for locks that were lost or broken, and good locks with no keys that no one could open. If he had a row with me mother, that's where he'd go, although it wasn't often they had a row. If there was an animal down or a friend of his died, you'd see him through the window, just standing inside at the bench by the drawer. As time went on, he went there a lot. He opened the drawer and sometimes not. The divisions and compartments had started to crumble. Everything was there. It was just such a scramble to find what he wanted. But he still fixed things, or he thought he did. And sometimes he fixed things that were already fixed. Mostly he put on his glasses, marked glasses, from the pouch on the shelf, and he tidied the bench, and he tied bits of twine. And he fumbled through the drawer and said, "Oh my, all these things so precious," and he didn't know why. Such an easygoing man, or so they all said. He kept his world in a drawer, under the bench, in the shed.
Oh, that was absolutely beautiful. That was The Drawer by Seamus O'Rourke, as heard on Countrywide. Now, fasten your seatbelts because we're taking off, which is my rather clumsy segue into air travel, because the weather and how of our return to the skies was something that took up a lot of airtime this week. Oh, the puns. That's the podcast for you. Forgive me. But by Thursday evening, we had the news that the Cabinet had approved the easing of some travel restrictions between Ireland and other countries from July 9th. But let's scroll back to how this all played out over the week. On Tuesday, a government task force on the aviation industry delivered its interim findings. They called for the ban on non-essential travel and the two-week quarantine requirements be lifted by Wednesday, July 1st. Here's how Fergal Keane described the makeup of this group.
They all have what we call skin in the game. Now, they were put together only earlier this month and as representatives from the airlines, the tourist industry, airports, unions and officials then from government departments. They were meant to report on July 10th to the minister, Shane Ross, but they've come out with this interim report today recommending the more or less immediate lifting of restrictions from next Wednesday, that's July 1st. The minister said today that there were important public health issues to be considered, which means that Neffid would be running their eye over this before anything happens, but it is quite a strong recommendation.
Skin in the game, eh? Well, all of this against the backdrop of Dublin Airport Authority losing €1 million a day. Mary Wilson spoke to Joe Gill of Goodbody Stockbrokers about an industry in crisis.
How severe is this crisis? I mean, have we ever seen its likes before? Pat Byrne, the boss of CityJet, telling Fergal Keane earlier, he could see 30 to 40% of the airlines going under.
I think that's reasonable. This is a catastrophic crisis across the industry. We're seeing airlines collapsing pretty much every week. Today, a German charter airline collapsed. Virgin Australia has gone bust. The flag carrier in Mexico looks like it's going into Chapter 11, and there's a whole stream of other ones that may well be heading that way as we approach winter. So there could well be surplus capacity in the order of 20 to 30% in the global commercial airline fleet. And those airlines that are left standing are in an enfeebled state and requiring a lot of financial support to actually stay in business currently and to prepare for the recovery.
So clearly an aviation industry on its knees and, of course, job losses with that. But how to balance this against public health concerns was the question up for debate. The following day, Sarah McInerney spoke to Dr. Gabriel Scally, and she asked his opinion on dropping the 2-week quarantine period.
Oh, well, I don't think that should happen. I doubt if very many people outside the aviation industry would think that was a sensible thing to do. No, we need to keep up the barriers at the moment. And I think the way forward is to have, first of all, a zero COVID island of Ireland, and then to make the travel links with other places that are in a similarly good situation. When you look at, and of course, our busiest air link and one of the busiest air links in Europe is the one between Dublin and London. At the moment in England, they estimate they have 4,300 new cases of COVID-19 every day occurring, of which they're finding around about 1,000. So, and contact tracing, only a proportion of those. So the situation is not under control in our nearest neighbour, and one of our most frequent airline destinations. And similarly with the United States, seeing very large upsurges in places that have lifted things too soon.
But what about the rest of Europe, Dr. Scally? Because again, the Aviation Task Force pointing out that Ireland is significantly behind other EU member states in lifting travel restrictions.
Well, I don't regard the EU as particularly having public health competencies. If I'm taking European advice on health grounds, on health issues, it would be for the European Centre for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. I understand that EU, as representing the countries, has a very strong economic drive. But this is a public health emergency, and I very strongly feel that public health concerns have to trump airline worries.
Dr. Gabriel Scally with Sarah on Wednesday, and he mentioned the WHO because back on Monday, COVID-19 envoy David Nabarro was asked this by Mary Wilson.
Where are you on travel? Irish people, we're in the holiday season. Some people want to go to Spain or to Portugal for their their much longed for 2-week vacation, their little blast of sunshine. Should they go?
Yeah, I think so. What we need to be looking at is if a country has got a low level of virus and also has got really strong, good public health services, and another country is approaching it the same way, then there should be travel between these countries because they've got equalisation of risks. And that's the right thing to do.
Without quarantine.
And I think so, yeah. Because, you know, you're just as likely to get it in Spain as you are in Ireland if you've sorted out the risks. So why not? Why impose the quarantine? And I think if you can do it with equalisation of risks, it'll be tough, there'll be lots of negotiation, then that's how it should be done. But let's say you're trying to bring somebody from a particular place where there's a lot of disease to Ireland, then it's not going to be like that. Then the quarantine, either quarantine at home or quarantine in a place organised by the government, that's going to be necessary. Because if the risk is unequal, then there should be some special attention at the border.
The WHO's David Nabarro with Mary Wilson on Monday, so he would fly within certain confines. What about Professor Luke O'Neill, who spoke to Ryan Tuberty on Wednesday?
Would you get on an airplane in July?
No. Personally, I probably wouldn't. Ryan.
Why not?
Well, maybe that was over. If I could be assured of certain things, I would. Let's put it that way.
Wouldn't
right?
We all do things if we could?
Wouldn't we? I know. Well, again, it's risk mitigation.
No, but you wouldn't go on a plane.
I would only go on a plane in the following circumstances. That if the airport has a proper testing regimen before you go into the airport, and that may be possible. So in other words, you arrive at the airport, you get a test, and if you're negative, you can go into the airport. That decreases me catching it off you. Secondly, when I'm on the plane, I want to make sure everybody's wearing masks. Great hygiene, great air circulation is the key thing because that's another mitigator. You know, if all those things are in place and I'm confident they're there, then I probably would fly. But the truth is, planes are well known through decades. You catch the flu on an airplane. People spread viruses easily on planes because it's a confined space. So there's a few measures there. Now, if they are talking about those measures, by the way, you see, which still be in place. So if those measures are in place, then I would fly. But at the moment, I wouldn't be certain about flying.
Okay, maybe, but depending on where we might be flying. Certain countries are doing very well, so yeah, buckle up, go there. Others, not so much. UK. So where, oh where, might that leave our relationship with our nearest and dearest COVID-y neighbours? On Thursday, Sarah spoke to Deirdre Heenan, Professor of Social Policy at the University of Ulster.
Well, I mean, air bridges are, as we might rightly call them, travel corridors. When we decide which countries we're going to be, we need to look at the level of disease, the trajectory of the disease, whether or not there's a test and trace system, what is social distancing, have they flattened the curve? And if you look at all of those indicators, then you would say that Ireland would not be wanting a travel corridor with Britain, given their track record over the disease. So that's on paper what would happen. Practically, it's very, very difficult, and politically, also very difficult.
As if Brexit hadn't created enough passive-aggressive tension between us. Might we risk John Bull getting the hump?
But in terms of the political and diplomatic impacts then, do you think that they would be significant, or do you think that British politicians would see this as just something that has to be done? They wouldn't take it personally.
I don't think they would take it personally, but I do think it would become an issue. And as your previous commentator mentioned, these issues are always interesting when they bubble up in Anglo-Irish relations. And remember, this is a time where we're negotiating a trade deal with the EU. Anglo-Irish relations probably have never been worse in terms of Brexit and the fallout from Brexit. So the British politicians will be looking to Ireland and saying, are Ireland trying to punish us? What are they actually trying to do here? But also, I think Ireland have to say to people who have dealt with the regulations, who have had restrictions on their lives, that they really must do everything they can to ensure that there isn't a second spike. And if they're really going to say, after all of this lockdown, that we're going to open our doors, fling them open and let everyone in with no restrictions, then people are going to say, well, what was the point of this? Why do we have to go through this pain?
Oh, not a bad point, but not everyone agreed. Later the same day, Mary Wilson spoke to Tory MP Andrew Bridgen.
In your view, should economics trump science? How do you hold the balance?
There's been terrible infections across the whole of Europe. I'd be interested to see if the UK is not included in an air bridge, which countries are included. I think that'll be very telling. And obviously, there will be a feeling that there is some politics coming into this, given that the EU future relationship trade deal negotiations have stalled. And I just really wouldn't want those politics to get involved in the relationship between our two countries, especially when we're so economically dependent upon each other.
Do you think a move like this would be problematic for Anglo-Irish relations?
It depends how it's if the decision is made not to have an air bridge with the UK. I think it will be inconvenient for a large number of our citizens who travel frequently between the two countries, and it will be more difficult for business. But if it's seen as a political move, of course it will be detrimental to the relationship between UK and the Republic of Ireland, which is nothing I want to see at all. I don't want to see that at all. And indeed, I would have hoped that the Republic of Ireland's government was lobbying the EU very hard to make sure that we do get a free trade deal, tariff and quota free trade, exactly as we've got now, which the UK is offering.
Do you really think that the EU and this country would play politics with health, with COVID-19?
Well, what can I say, Mary?
I would hope not.
But we will see, won't we? We will see.
Well, the other guest on that item was Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And to say he strongly disagreed, well, understatement.
But I really need to take issue with this issue, this concern about politics. This is purely driven by the epidemiology. The Irish government is not introducing politics into it. Now, I'm well aware that Andrew Bridgen is very keen on developing and maintaining close links with the Republic of Ireland. And I remember in November 2019 that he said, and I quote, "I still think that the Republic of Ireland will be the next country to leave the EU ahead of us." So I recognise that wish for a close relationship, but this is nothing to do with politics. It's entirely to do with the science.
Martin McKee on Thursday's Drive Time, but back a few days to Tuesday. What if we were fully allowed to hop on any flight spontaneously, willy-nilly, a weekend in Bruges, a winter sunsplash to Thailand? What might that look like? Would we really go? Well, Mary Wilson spoke to travel journalist Simon Calder, and by the way, he'd just booked a flight to Dublin for the princely sum of €22.
Do you believe that with quarantine and travel restrictions lifted, that the public will return to travel in the numbers they were travelling, that they will return to the foreign holidays, the midweek breaks, the weekend breaks, the trips to long haul to Thailand, the Middle East, America, Australia, in the numbers that they were doing it?
Initially, definitely not to any of those. Longer term, certainly the 2 week holiday in the Mediterranean, that will be back. The long haul trip of a lifetime to the Far East or Australia, that will be back. But it's these discretionary weekends, flying to somewhere you can't spell or pronounce in Eastern Europe just because it only costs €30 return. I think that sort of journey may well disappear. Mm. And I think we will. You know, there will be a lot less aviation. Hopefully it will be greener. Hopefully we will appreciate it a little bit more, and we won't be quite so blasé.
Might you pay much more to fly to Dublin than the £22 that you paid this week?
Yes, I think I almost certainly will. I mean, there will need to be very, very cheap fares just to stimulate the market in the short term. But longer term, I think the kinds of fares I've been paying through this winter will be turn out to be an all-time low. And yeah, I think €40-50 would be a reasonable fare on Ryanair, and I'll get used to paying that to get to Dublin.
All well and good, but have we entirely forgotten about our ever-present climate emergency?
A listener, Simon, asks whether we really want to return aviation to the unsustainable levels of the past, given that it is a major contributor to carbon emissions.
I can absolutely see that there's a lot of sense in that argument. And of course, the environment has been blessed by the past few months, even though tens of thousands of people have had their jobs sadly lost. I think the one thing that this is doing is an absolute wholesale clear out of all the old gas guzzling aircraft, the Boeing 747s, which have been in service for 50 years or so. Even the Airbus A380 is being, I think, phased out, and we're going to see much more efficient aircraft. And that has to be a good thing. Overwhelmingly, though, aviation has always come back. It's always grown. It's simply a matter of whether we can do so sustainably until someone comes up with a decent electric plane.
Simon Calder of the London Independent with Mary Wilson. There is, of course, the sail and rail option, because not so long ago, flights were the preserve of those with wads of cash stuffed in their monogrammed waistcoat pockets. As Joseph O'Connor recalled on Sunday Miscellany 50, in the late 1980s, taking the ferry to England was more than just a matter of getting from A to B.
Late 1980s Ireland. Picture, if you will, an Arctic wasteland ruled by a wicked, vengeful wizard and his team of sniggering hobbits with dark, empty eyes. Then remove the fun. You're not far from Ireland, 1987. A country where excitement was constitutionally illegal unless you happened to be a sheep or a nun. Unemployment was high, confidence was low, self-esteem was not felt to be useful. The wind moaned all night in the voice of Charlie Haughey. A plane ticket to London cost £500, so most of us went on the ferry. That is my memory of mid-1980s Ireland. Loss, country music and seasickness. The ship would roll and rock its way across the Irish Sea, as other ships had done for hundreds of years, loaded with hope and secrets. In the middle of the night, you'd arrive into Holyhead, the most dismal town in Britain. There you would trudge past the line of surly-looking special branch detectives and board the train for one of England's cities. And somewhere before dawn, a strange miracle would happen. Things would start to feel a bit better. The train would cross Britain's Midlands, past the factories and farmlands, the motorways sleeping in their sodium glare, and the million lights of London would loom in the distance, You were young, full of excitement at the things that might happen. Little things like a job or a private life.
Joseph O'Connor as heard on Sunday Miscellany 50. Chef Anna Hall was a guest on Des's Island Discs. She now has her own restaurant called Myrtle in London. But Des took her right back to how she found working in the kitchens of high-end restaurants.
What were your early experiences of kitchens?
I loved it. I loved it. The hours didn't bother me. The failing did. That was very hard because when you're a young chef, you don't understand anything. You don't understand control. And to be a chef, it's all about control. Control of temperature, control of timing, control of your thoughts, control of your section. Like, everything is all about understanding, you know, what 1 minute can do to a meal or to a service or to an evening. But I loved it. I just became, and still do feel like I become alive when I'm in the kitchen. When that machine starts going clickety click 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 and the orders come through, my heart beats faster. But it was extremely hard. You are right. It's a unmatched kind of environment when it comes to working in a kitchen, because it's quite open, but it's also very private. So sometimes people's control is the problem, you know, too much control and maybe losing control. It can be a dark place.
And Anna had honed her skills working in London and then Paris, a venture she approached with a certain devil-may-care attitude.
I think it's hilarious, and I think about my parents. I mean, listening to this now, they'll laugh. You know, they brought me to the airport to pack me off to Paris, and I was like, and they were like, "You all set for your accommodation?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah." "You all set for your job?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Got it totally all sorted." I arrived to Paris and I had nowhere to live and I had no job. I just thought, if I get over there, because I did send applications out, I did try, but I didn't get any response, to my CV. And then day one, as soon as I hit Paris, I found somewhere to live. And then I found a job, I think, on day two or three. And that was it. Like, that's the behaviour of a madwoman.
It is a bit. Well, let's go through that. So you had nowhere to live.
Nowhere to live?
And how did you get somewhere?
I booked a hostel, and it was a gorgeous hostel which had a lovely view of the Eiffel Tower, if you don't mind. I remember my first food shop I did was €50, so I wasn't a woman who was ready to be living in a hostel. Yeah. And my whole memory of Paris, I can remember the smell of Paris walking down through the streets in a good way. Some people would disagree about the smell of Paris, but it was such a time of excitement and discovery and just really believing that I was becoming a chef.
Anna Hall with Des Cahill. Dr. Matthew Jebb is the director of the National Botanic Gardens of Ireland, and he came on Mooney Goes Wild to talk about biting bumblebees. Now, bees, we always knew that they were clever, but there's a devious little streak to them. Have a listen to this.
Well, one of the interesting things about the drought, a lot of people who are vegetable gardeners will know that if your little lettuces and cabbages get too dry, they immediately start flowering. They bolt into flowers, which is very frustrating. So you've got to keep up a good watering regime. Now, one of the extraordinary things that was spotted just very recently, so this publication appeared 1 month ago, entomologists in Switzerland were doing experiments with bumblebees, and they noticed the bumblebees were biting the leaves of the plant. And they thought, that's very odd. You know, has that ever been reported before? And then they realised that the bitten plants were flowering 16 days to 30 days earlier than normal. And what they did with various little manipulations experiments, if you starve bees, so you keep them in an enclosure where they can't get flowers and pollen, they start to attack the plants and bite little holes in them, and this causes them to flower much sooner. So they are manipulating the plants. They're acting like little farmers to encourage the flowers into flowering a month earlier.
So has this been... No, the bees are.
The bees are doing this.
Not the actual gardeners.
Not the gardeners. They're behaving like little gardeners. So these bees... nobody had noticed this before, and that is the really astonishing thing. And they've realised that three species of bumblebee were doing this. They were biting tomatoes and other plants that they were keeping in the enclosure with them, every time they were starved of pollen and nectar, they would attack these plants, pierce little holes in them. Now,
And they weren't eating the lumps of the leaves.
They weren't eating them, but the biologist said, right, well, let's mimic this. We'll take a scalpel and cut little holes in the leaves of the plant. And sure enough, that stress caused the plants to flower earlier, but not as early as the bee-bitten ones.
Oh, that's absolutely fascinating. That was Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens of Ireland. But in the middle of all this, Derek and Aina seemed to forget that there was a guest in studio and got into what we might call a family spat.
Well, Aina Nealana was talking about that last week to Niall Hatch, remember? Didn't you say the bees were eating his plants? Do you remember?
Biting
his plants.
The leaves.
The bees.
Well,
yeah,
they certainly.
Did you not say that last week?
I didn't.
You did. I'll have to get the tape. What was it?
Bees have been known to.
I'm nearly
bite
sure
into,
of it, Aina. I'll have to check the audio.
Yes, indeed.
They've been known to bite into flowers to steal the nectar because it's easier than putting your nose all the way up a flower. You just bite the base of a flower and steal the nectar that way. So bees have been known to do this for centuries.
And then hummingbirds do it as well. It's mad behaviour. It might have been mentioned in the hummingbirds biting the backs of the flowers because it's a hiding to nothing. Because if they don't.
Well, we couldn't have been because we don't have hummingbirds here. We've got hummingbird hawk moths, but we don't have the hummingbirds here. It was definitely bees. Definitely.
Very deep nectar.
But let it go, guys. But later, there was a climb down of sorts.
Anyway,
yes,
the leaf cutting bee, I know what it is now.
Go on, yeah.
It was a leaf cutting bee, which is a solitary bee. It's not a bumblebee.
Yeah. Oh. No, but I knew it was a bee. Yeah, I just couldn't remember.
You were quite right.
Thank you, Aina.
We were talking about him.
I think it's the first time in 25 years you've actually said that to me.
That you were right.
Yeah.
You know, the 25 probably won't say it again. But anyway, I must be old age creeping up on me. But the leaf cutter bee actually cuts lumps out of leaves, takes the lumps of leaves away with them and brings them back to the nest as part of the nest building.
Yes,
and
yes.
Food that they, so that was a different bee to the bumblebee. You're right, it was a bee, but it wasn't the bumblebee. It was a leaf cutter
bee. But it was a bee nonetheless.
It was a bee nonetheless.
And we did discuss it last. I thought I was losing my mind. Matthew, stay with us if you would, Aina.
Oh, well, he might hang around if you stopped fighting. Bee one-upmanship, Derek and Aina on the always entertaining, never dull, Mooney Goes Wild. On Wednesday, Ray and crew did a rather special programme where they invited a representative from each of the 32 counties to join an island-wide Zoom call where people expressed their thanks for those nearest and dearest to them and some strangers who had helped get them through the last few months of this pandemic. One of those saying thank you was Eilish from County Tyrone.
How you doing, Eilish?
Hiya, Ray.
Who's that with you?
So this is my daughter, Tess. She's 11 months, so she'll be making plenty of noise.
And Tess is part of the reason you want to get on and say thanks.
Yes, Tess. Tess has Down syndrome, and we are very lucky that she goes to the Child Development Clinic in Dungannon Hospital, which is nearby to us, for therapy every couple of weeks. Obviously, then with COVID, all services had to stop, but our therapists are fantastic and have been keeping in touch via telephone so that we could keep on working with Tess, which is just amazing.
And Tess is very doughty. She's very doughty there.
She's so funny. She really is.
And I'm sure they'll appreciate it that you got on and made a very public thank you there. So it's all the OT and physio at the Child Development Clinic in Dungannon Hospital. Thanks, Eilish. Thank you. Thanks so much.
And as they whipped around the country, we heard thank you to, yes, the frontline workers, but also undertakers and a vet who'd helped heal the leg of a broken cat. We also spoke to Frances from Carlow.
Okay, so when you did the call for someone from Carlow, I just wanted to represent people that lived an ordinary life in very extraordinary times. So thank you to my family for sustaining me. Thank you to our children for getting on board with it. Thank you to the teachers for adapting and seesaw apping and emailing me. Thank you to the musicians for sharing their music so freely. Thank you to David Williams for reading his books for Elevenses and to John Boyne for inspiring stories. Thank you to Zoom for my chats with friends. Thank you to WhatsApp for keeping lines open between the four corners of Ireland and beyond. Thank you to RTE for the homeschool hub done with crack. Thank you to the radio for being in the kitchen with us it had our back. Thank you to the neighbours for their nods and chats at a distance. Thank you to the shop workers for keeping us fed. Thank you to Care Doc and Dr. Byrne, to Kathy, his secretary, on the phone. Thank you to the bin collectors there and on time. Thank you to the community volunteers and to the church online. Thank you to the virtual choirs and sing-alongs. Thank you to Creative Ireland's Cruinniún an Óg Day for the wolf poem that came out of my daughter's imagination. Thank you to waterways workers and those who keep our barrow walks and locality maintained. Thank you to all for keeping us the same.
Frances from Carlow, just one of the 32 voices we heard on the Ray D'Arcy Show on Wednesday for the great national thank you. And that is it for this week's podcasted playback, and we'll be back in the usual morning slot next week. Thanks for listening. Talk to you then.